Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades from movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Bant. Along with me on this journey revisiting 80s movies is my co-host, Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
I'll tell you one thing that happens when you get married. You have to give up your old friends, because the wife wants you to get new friends. New friends. Nope. It's you and me. You and me, buddy. We got secrets she'll never know. Never know. Those new friends will never be as good. Nope. Because we've got a history. History.
That's right, listeners. We are discussing, with spoilers aplenty, the 1982 comedy drama Diner, produced and distributed by Metro Goodwin Meyer. It stars Steve Guttenberg, Mickey Rourke, Kevin Bacon, Daniel Stern, Tim Daly, Ellen Barkin, and Paul Reiser. Written and directed by Barry Levinson, this movie is rated R with a running time of 1 hour and 50 minutes. It was nominated for one Oscar, Best Writing Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
You're in for a real treat at the diner. A rare contemporary comedy with wit, pathos, and bite. This lively and penetrating tale of a group of friends trying to recapture their lost innocence created an immediate sensation among audiences and critics. The cast of young actors, all of whom have gone on to greater fame, turn in uniformly superb performances. Their dialogue, their quirks, their aspirations are all remarkably familiar, making this a special film experience that's both poignant and wildly funny. Diner is set in 1959 in a Baltimore diner where a band of longtime buddies gather to make sense of their lives. Just out of college, they are starting to drift apart, but they still cling to the group rituals they've shared since boyhood. It may be a doomed attempt to hold on to the past, but that won't stop them, or you, from having a real good fling. Diner.
Diner. Jason, I am craving a turkey club sandwich now.
Bill Bant, I just took the sugar dispenser and poured myself a mouthful.
There you go.
And just washed it down with some Coke, so I'm ready to go, pal.
So that was What's on the Box, and let's move on to our earliest memories of this film. Jason, start us off.
Yeah, let's go back to 1982, man. Let's hit that diner and hang out for some French fries with gravy on top. What do you say? So, Bill Bant, yet again, here's another one I wasn't super familiar with, surprisingly enough. Because this is a classic, and I am aware that it is revered, that it's got a stellar cast, but it's one I've never seen all the way through. I do recall seeing that iconic scene with Mickey Rourke and the girl known as Carol Heathrow and the popcorn box. Don't ask me why I only saw that scene when I was a kid, but I was very young, and I remember thinking it was dirty. As in borderline X-rated, and somehow this is an issue or an instance where there was a Mandela effect, because I thought the scene was somehow more revealing than it actually is in this film. I don't know why I remember that way. Obviously, My mind went somewhere else. Anyway, there's part of me that wants to say I tried giving this movie a watch at some point when I was older, later on, but lost interest and didn't get very far. And if that happened, it was probably because I was hooked on the action films of the time. I didn't have much of a relationship to these actors in 82 until, of course, Footloose comes around with Kevin Bacon, and then you get Police Academy, Cocoon, Three Men and a Baby with Steve Guttenberg. There's a little bit of Mickey Rourke that I got from watching Angel Heart and A Prayer for the Dying, and I remember watching that one in college. Thanks a lot, Tom McKenzie. Love that one. Of course, there was Wild Orchid that followed that, and I had to watch Harley Davidson in The Marlboro Man in the early 90s because Don Johnson was in it. I mean, come on. Then I would know Paul Reiser from Mad About You and Aliens, which we covered on this podcast. And I would know Daniel Stern from the Home Alone movies and City Slickers, and then Tim and Daly from the great show Wings. But man, I just didn't know these actors before they were huge because of those films and TV shows I mentioned. So I just wasn't aware of them in 82. And because I had no attachment to this film, I didn't realize that, well, yeah, they were all in it together. So I was really looking forward to seeing this group of actors work alongside one another in this Barry Levinson-directed film and to see it in its full entirety, finally. That's all I got, Bill Bandt. What about you as far as earliest memories go?
So this is the first time you've seen it all the way through?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I feel like we've done like three or four in a row now that I haven't seen all the way there.
Next year, you'll schedule.
That's all good.
Yeah, for me, for my earliest memories, I remember going to the local video store, Discount Video, and I would see this VHS box on the shelf, and on the cover was our five main leads. And over the years, I would see that box and go, oh, Kevin Bacon. I saw him in Footloose. Steve Guttenberg. Yeah, I saw him in Police Academy. Oh, Mickey Rourke. Yeah, I saw him in Year of the Dragon. Daniel Stern. Yes, he was in Blue Thunder. Paul Reiser from Aliens is in this? Ellen Barkin from The Big Easy? Wait, it's directed by Barry Levinson, who directed The Natural? Oh, I need to rent this. Sorry, no Tim Daly yet. I know it was sometime between seeing Rain Man and Avalon, so somewhere between 88 and 90, that I watched this for the first time. And certainly watching it at that age, I would certainly lean more into the comedy aspects of this movie. Are you going to finish that? The pecker and the popcorn. Do you need a ride home? And I used to watch this movie a lot in the 90s. And then for some reason, I just kind of stopped watching it. But this is one of those movies I love where you go back and watch actors' early work. And when you look at the cast, the top eight on this, they all went on to have successful careers. And granted, yeah, Tim Daly didn't really know anything he did in the 80s, but then he goes on to do Wings, which I think was seven seasons. It was a hit show there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, huge success for him. So everyone got a hit out of this. You wouldn't mind trading places with any of their careers. They all did really well. So the nostalgia factor for that, I really enjoyed. And then just even Barry Levinson himself, I was such a huge fan of everything that he did to go back and finally sit down and watch it. I thought it was a blast, and I think I saw it at the right time myself, because here I was going into college, and this movie really deals with them after college, maybe a year or two after that, and then them just trying to find their way, and everything just kind of happens at the diner, and thinking to myself, oh, I wonder if I'll have that place where me and my friends will go to all the time and have our discussions and stuff. You know, I always like period pieces, because it does feel like it's always timeless. No matter when you watch it, it never feels dated. Yeah, this is one I watched a lot. Surprised I don't own it, because I do remember enjoying it. Usually I'm always waiting for like the special edition to get it. So maybe that's why I did it. And then maybe by the time it did come out, I just kind of missed it. Yeah, this is one I definitely caught a lot. Late 80s, early 90s. And it's been a while since I watched it. So looking forward to going back and discussing some more.
Can't wait to get into it. And totally agree that the period really works in this film. And although I had never seen it in its entirety, I've watched it a couple of times now for this podcast. And I tell you what, I can't wait to own it. And it works because it's dated, because it does take you back. It takes you back to a different time. I happen to be a huge fan of the 50s. I love that decade. I love asking people this question. It's like, if you could go back in time, which decade would you go back to? And the 50s is always in like the top two choices. I have, like, I'm a big fan of American Graffiti and 50s, 60s, around that classic era, and great music, all of that stuff, the style, the dress, the lingo, the diners, of course. But for me, watching this, even though, like I said, I'd never seen it before in its entirety, this still made me nostalgic for those times of my past, because I think back to now 30 plus years ago and the hangouts that I used to go to with my friends. And I'll get into that a little bit later. So this just, yeah, made me really, really think about the good old days. Brought some warm and fuzzy feelings back for me. Are we ready to get into some initial thoughts?
Yeah, go ahead. What are your initial thoughts?
Thanks for the go-ahead, man. Let's first and foremost talk about our director, Barry Levinson. This is his feature film directorial debut and would be the first in his what is called the Baltimore Tetralogy, meaning four films. The other three Baltimore-based films are Tin Men in 87, Avalon in 90, and then Liberty Heights in 1999. And this is from Wikipedia. Good old Barry is best known for his works, which are usually mid-budget comedy dramas and drama films, such as this diner, The Natural, which Bill Bant mentioned. Oh man, what a classic. Good Morning Vietnam, which we covered on this pod. Bugsy, Wag the Dog. And Levinson did win the Academy Award for Best Director for Rain Man in 1988. And I have a hot take when it comes to that movie. I think that's Tom Cruise's best performance still to this date. I know, hot take. In 2021, Barry Levinson also co-executive produced the Hulu miniseries Dope Sick and directed the first two episodes. I actually love that show. That's pretty gut-wrenching, but I enjoyed Dope Sick and Michael Keaton, of course, in that particular miniseries. Getting into my initial thoughts, in my research, I came across an article entitled Counterculture Diner Revisited by Max Weiss from the online magazine Baltimore. And it mentions that this film kicked off the comedy genre entitled the Hangout Comedy, which really is the way to describe this movie. And it may sound cliche these days, but you just don't see this type of movie anymore, especially in present cinema. More often, probably an episodic television series, maybe prestige TV series on your streaming network. But this is a comedy, maybe a dramedy, about a group of five guys hanging out post-college in the midst of figuring out what the next step is. And it does take place in Baltimore in 1959 over Christmas and New Year's, or about to be New Year's. And we follow their lives over a handful of days, and that's it. Nothing more, nothing less. There's no real major arc or journey to follow. There's little ones. No major obstacles. There's a couple semi-larger obstacles, not anything huge to overcome or any seriously traumatic events that occur. It's just these guys that are living life, man. Making their daily choices, sometimes feeling the immediate consequences and sometimes pondering the long-term effects of those choices. And they do it together. The point is, they're real guys dealing with their own issues. And despite what may happen, they always have each other and their place of respite, their place of camaraderie and meeting of the minds and the laughter and the memories and the place of escape, which is the diner. It's built into their shared existence. It's part of them. It's part of their history. So yeah, this is slice of life, man, and I really dug it. Boogie, the character played by Mickey Rourke, is a smooth-talking womanizer with gambling problem. You've got Shrevey, played by Daniel Stern. He got married a little younger, and he's just now learning what that means. You got Eddie Simmons, played by Steve Guttenberg. He's about to get married himself. Then you got Fenwick, played by Kevin Bacon. He's got a bit of a drinking problem tied to some anger issues, tied to some family dysfunction. And then you get Billy, who comes back into town from school, little postgraduate school, and he's back in town and dealing with the unrequited love of a woman he finds out he got pregnant and now wants to marry. Last but not least, we got to mention there's Modell. Paul Reiser, who's hilarious in this. I love that guy. And he's just kind of hanging out as the neurotic comic relief. And yeah, outside of Eddie getting married at the end of this film, and Boogie getting his ass saved from a gambling debt. Nothing huge or surprising or unexpected takes place. It's a coming-of-age movie. It's existential. It's just a movie about these dudes. It's a movie about guys growing up or trying to grow up. It's about guys realizing they're going to have to make changes. It's life. Man, this movie works because of the casting, the chemistry, the performances, the real feel for an almost two-hour movie based around conversations. It flows. I enjoyed watching these guys be themselves. Like I said, natural performances combined with great writing and improvisation. Steve Guttenberg is a goofy bastard in this. He's kind of a likable douchebag? Does that make any sense? He's so contradictory, I don't even know what to do with the guy. But I still like him somehow. Kevin Bacon, hadn't seen him like this before in this particular performance. This is early on in his career, just post Guiding Light run, his soap opera run. And then Mickey Rourke, I mean, what can you say about this guy? I watched the dude, you know, like I went off when we covered Body Heat and I went off on the small scene that he was in. I'm like, this guy is magnetic. He's just got it. And in an interview with TCM, the channel, Turner Classic Movies, years later, Kevin Bacon said that Guttenberg, he looked up to Mickey Rourke as a kind of mentor or teacher. And Bacon felt Rourke was very intense and skilled at being very, very small in terms of his subtlety, doing work that you almost are unable to see being shot at the time. And then it gets on camera and it just, you know, explodes into something great. I thought that was a really good description of Mickey Rourke and what he does. He does these small things, and when you're just watching him going, he's really real. Anyway, he does this thing in this movie where he continually, when he's in scenes with the girls, with the women in this film, he continually touches their faces and their hair when he wants something, and it works. It's just one of his tics in this movie, and he gets away with it. And of course, a lot of it is his look. I mean, he's a great-looking dude. And so much of it is his voice. He's got this soft, slightly higher pitched voice, which I just never really paid attention to before. Can't say enough about Mickey Rourke. Can't forget about Ellen Barkin, a very young Ellen Barkin in this. She's beautiful, and I've always thought she was very sexy, but she's much younger in this and more cute than sexy, I guess you could say. But pretty woman, excellent actress. Man, it's got the place, the diner, Fells Point Diner. It's got the feel, the city feel. It's got the soundtrack, all great 50s songs. I particularly loved the use of Where or When. I'm a big fan of that song off the When Harry Met Sally soundtrack, which is the Harry Connick Jr. version, but the Where or When, the classic version, is in here. Language, the vernacular of the time, saying she's death, meaning like she's, I'm assuming, super hot. Is that what it means, Bill Bandt, back in the day? Is that what they used to say
in Baltimore? It took me two or three times to realize that's what it meant.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, Carol Heathrow, she's death, man.
Meaning, yeah, first like, I thought it was bad news.
All right, like she'll be the death of you.
Yeah.
No, it means like she's that hot. She might stop your heart or something like that. Or Kevin Bacon says a lot in this, it's a smile, meaning like it's a gas, man. Like it's a thrill. This is fun. I love that lingo. And Bill Bandt, you know what? I kept thinking this is what St. Elmo's Fire should have been.
Yes.
Post-college, people hanging out. This is what it should have been. Watching this movie through today's societal lens, I can easily say that not everything feels PC, or I don't agree with the way these guys treat women overall. Not a fan of how Eddie treats his mom, how Boogie treats any women in this, or how Shrevey treats his wife Beth, or how Fenn sells his date for $5 in the beginning of this movie. But I will say this, the movie feels honest. And that's the difference between this and kind of like a St. Elmo's Fire, which has a lot of superficial BS in it. I don't want to bag on St. Elmo's Fire. I'd like that for its own reasons or my own reasons. But I believe this movie and what's going on in it. And thus, it's interesting. And maybe, just maybe, it makes me feel uncomfortable because I used to be one of these guys at that age. There's something to be said about a movie that makes me look at myself and my journey, but just not my journey, our journey, meaning me and my friends and me and my diner friends. I'm lucky to have friends, and I know what it's like. And what the banter is like and what makes it real. And this movie nails it. That's why it's classic. It's just got it right in a way that feels truly organic. We have to believe it. And it's small things in this movie that make it feel authentic. It's just something like meeting the guys go to the train station and meet Billy. And the first thing Boogie does is take the suitcase from him and carry it for him, because that's what friends do. Such a simple thing, but it's a really smart choice by Mickey Rourke in that role. Or it's really smart direction by Levinson. I got into this movie, Bill Bant, and not all of it is serious. I mean, this is a comedy and it manages to stay light on its feet, which I was thankful for because interestingly enough, I'm now attuned to these prestige series when eventually the event happens, as in this a traumatic event that brings everyone together. So I was kind of watching this movie, waiting for the other shoe to drop, for the shit to hit the fan. This big event was going to happen and it never did, which was refreshing. That's all I got for initial thoughts, Bill Bant. I love this movie. What are your initial thoughts?
All right. So I apologize to our listeners if it seems like I'm kind of repeating what Jason's saying, but I think we're almost on the same page. So for me, yes, this is a slice of life movie. Nothing is really going on, yet a lot is going on. So we have our five main characters, Eddie, Shrevey, Boogie, Finn, and Billy, plus Modell, who supplies the comic relief. They are all in their early 20s. The overarching story is Eddie is possibly getting married New Year's Eve, so Billy comes back to town for the holidays and to be the best man at this possible wedding. And the wedding is only a possibility because if Eddie's fiance can't pass a football quiz, the wedding is off. So that's possibly the main story. During all this, Billy finds out his best friend, who is a girl, is possibly pregnant with his child after a one-night fling, and then Billy's trying to do the right thing by marrying her, but she wants no part of it. Shrevey, who is currently the only married man in this group, is already having minor marital problems. He doesn't seem to connect socially with his wife. And then we have Boogie, the one everyone seems to look up to, has made a $2,000 bet he can't cover if he loses. So he is using women on the side to make bets that he can get them in bed. And then we have Finn, who could possibly be an alcoholic, has a lot of family problems, and not all these storylines get wrapped up in the end. We get introduced to some other characters as the movie moves along. It will even cut away from the story to see a bread delivery being made, or an owner yelling at his cook, or a horse-drawn carriage pulling junk down a street. But everything runs through the diner, and this is a cool centerpiece to this film. We never see any of the women in this film at the diner. It's the haven for the men. It's the HQ and the one constant all of our main characters have. The conversations feel authentic, and it's easy to identify with them, even 60 years after this movie takes place. It is not a movie to watch when you're tired because it is very dialogue heavy. There's no big action set pieces or any of that kind of stuff, but it certainly reminds me of the dynamics I had with my friends in those early years after college. So that's my initial thoughts.
Yeah, that's it. You said it much more succinctly than I did, but I wanted to gush about all the other details that I had mentioned as well. And it's just that slice of life. Very, very relatable for us, I believe. So we can move right along into our favorite scenes and moments.
Let us do that. What are some of your favorite scenes and moments from Diner?
Diner from 1982. Well, the first favorite scene that I have down is the roast beef sandwich scene, or the first diner sequence.
Love the scene.
Yeah, it's pretty classic. And to think, stepping on trivia, it was almost cut out of the film. How dare they? But I kind of get it, because it doesn't necessarily move the story forward, but a lot of these scenes don't necessarily move any sort of narrative forward. We begin the film with a couple of title cards, and we know that it's Christmas night, and it is in Baltimore in 1959, and the film starts with the Christmas dance. And we're introduced to some of our protagonists like Modell and Boogie and Finn. And they are at the dance and we just get to know a little bit about them just from some of the banter back and forth. And basically cutting to the chase here, it's almost literally cutting to the chase. They're driving away from the dance and Fenwick is with a girl named Diane and the sweet little hot rod of a car. It's a convertible. And they're cruising along and they get way ahead of the other vehicles with Shrevey and Beth in one car. And you've got, I believe, is it Modell and Boogie in the other. But basically, Finn and Diane get way ahead of everybody else cruising in this little hot rod car. And then it cuts to these other two vehicles that finally catch up with Finn and they pull over and they stop. and they see that Fenn has been in what seems to be an awful car accident. And this is immediately Bill Bant. I'm like, oh, here we go, right off the bat. Here's the traumatic event that's somehow going to bring all these characters together. And we see Kevin Bacon lying on the ground. It seems like he's got all this blood on his face. Diane's nowhere to be seen, so we assume she's been thrown from the vehicle. The vehicle itself is turned on its side, and the guys come up, and they're just mouths open going, oh my God, what happened? Then Kevin Bacon, as Fenn, lying on the road, starts laughing. He played a practical joke on him. He actually got so far ahead of them down the road that he had time to turn over the car with the help of Diane and pretend as if he was dead, lying in the middle of the street, by putting ketchup on his face to mimic blood. Not a very funny joke. The guys don't find it all that funny, but they're like, Fenn, just taking it a little bit too far. We're like, okay. So we're getting a bit of an idea who these guys are, and especially Kevin Bacon at this moment. Character establishment here in the first two scenes, both at the Christmas dance and now playing this practical joke of a car accident. They get back into their cars, and they're going to meet at the diner later. So we're going to cut right to this diner sequence. And you just feel it right away. This is Christmas vacation. Whether it be in college or post-college or whatever, we all have these regular haunts that we would go back to. I certainly did. And this is where everybody congregates. But for these particular gentlemen, this is their second home. And you just get in there, you feel the action, the people moving around, and you know it's late at night, but it is hustling and bustling. And we get our guys that are probably sitting, I'm assuming, at their favorite table in their favorite booths. And we get Modell talking to both Eddie and Trevi, and they're all, you know, munching on some food. Fenwick shows up and sits down next to them, and they're like, hey, Fenn, how did it go with Diane? And Fenn makes some really bad joke about being really harsh to her, but ends up admitting the truth that they're probably going to go on a second date. And eventually, you get Modell, played by the great Paul Reiser, and his wonderful improvisation. He's just a comedic savant, like he's a genius. He's just so quick on his feet. And you can tell just by the banter between these gentlemen that a lot of this is improvised, which is part of the attraction and what makes this feel authentic. And we're going to use the word authentic and real a lot in this, because that's what is the main selling point of this movie and what makes it so relatable. So they're all noshing on some French fries and gravy and their sandwiches. And Eddie, Steve Guttenberg, has his roast beef sandwich in front of him. And Modell looks across the table at it and he says, yeah, you got to finish that? Because if you're not going to eat it, I'll have it. And then Eddie's like, no, I'm going to finish it. That's why I bought it. It's mine. This is just paraphrasing. I don't have all the dialogue written down for this. Eddie says, yeah, this is what he does. He's always beating around the bush. He just won't ask me directly if he wants the sandwich. And then Shrevey next to him, Daniel Stern, is chiming in. He's like, just, you know, he wants it. Then just say no if you don't want him to have it, or just say you want to eat it. And there's just this back and forth, a lot of crosstalk. They're talking over one another. Eddie's getting supremely annoyed because Modell just won't come out directly and ask for the roast beef sandwich. You have to understand, this is the movie. This is just conversations about nothing. But it's funny because you just get a real sense of their relationship to one another. And within their improvisation and then going to certain lines that are probably written, they're also individual characters unto themselves. You get a sense of who they are. Like Modell's the comic relief. He's a little more neurotic. You get Fenn, who's just a little bit nervous, kind of off the side, kind of smoking a cigarette and not paying attention as much. You get Shrevey, who's trying to be the moderator. He's the nice guy trying to broker a deal between these guys over this roast beef sandwich. And anyway, Eddie's getting supremely annoyed. There's a great line in here where Modell says, you know what your problem is, Eddie? You don't chew your food. That's why you get so irritable. Lumps of roast beef get stuck in your heart. They just stay there. Love that line. And then finally, Shrevey just takes the sandwich from Eddie, so neither of them get it. And Eddie absolutely loses. He's like, now you're going to eat the sandwich. It's great. Finally, Boogie, Mickey Rourke, shows up and he has a sidebar with a character named Bagel, who happens to be an older gentleman. I assume he's probably in his 40s or so, but he's like the adult hanging out with the other adults in the corner of this particular diner. There's always like a group of adults. You see mainly kids hanging around or younger adults sitting around, but there's this group of older gentlemen sitting off to the side. And already you just look at Bagel and you're like, oh, he must be kind of a man about town, nice guy, a little bit wiser, who knows, maybe has a nice job. You just can assume it by looking at him in this little conversation. And Bagel asks the younger Boogie about this $2,000 bet he laid down on a basketball game. And Boogie at first doesn't admit to making the bet, but then comes around. And Bagel's like, that wasn't a good idea, basically. And Boogie's like, don't worry about it. He walks back over to the guys that are sitting down. And he tries to get these guys in on this $2,000 bet on this basketball game, saying he knows they're shaving the points. He's got the inside info. And again, they're just going back and forth with this banter. I actually forgot to mention this whole scene starts with this question. Would you rather listen to Johnny Mathis or Frank Sinatra? And that's where this kind of heated discussion begins. And then it leads into the roast beef discussion and argument, et cetera. And then when Boogie comes around to sit down and talk about this bet, see if he can get some action from them on it. And they kind of go back and forth. Some of them don't want to get involved in the bet. Finally, Eddie asks Boogie directly, hey, who would you take, Mathis or Sinatra? And Boogie just says, Presley. As in Elvis Presley. And Eddie gets pissed off once again. He's just not getting his way tonight. And he's like, you're sick. You're sick, man. But he says this with a smile on his face. And he goes, you've gone two steps below in my book. And you can see in that moment, which is great, that Gutenberg either was totally making up the line or he lost his line in the moment. But man, it feels real. And it's really funny. And they're all cracking up. Daniel Stern actually spits up his coffee for real. Like it's an actual real spit take. You just want to be there with them. You want to be there in the scene. The diner food looks great. Everything is so palpable and tangible. And they just seem like guys that you know. Because I do know those guys. I was one of those guys. So it's very funny. That's what I got. What do you want to add to that? I have to believe this was one of your favorite scenes as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is Seinfeld before Seinfeld. It's a conversation about nothing. And what I love is we all have that friend, or we've all done it ourselves, where we kind of ask for something without directly asking for it because we don't want to maybe upset someone, or you don't want to guilt them into giving you the sandwich. So I just think it's hilarious that Paul Reiser, who plays Modell, is just beating around the bush about the question. And all Eddie wants is just directly ask me for the sandwich. I'll give you a yes or no answer. It would be hilarious if you got him to directly ask, and then he's like, no, I'm eating, and then just eat the sandwich in front of him. But this just works as funny, too. The rest of the guys at the table have probably heard this conversation 10, 20 times.
Right.
And they're just sick of it. But this is just what it is. This is what your friends do. They're just going to do it over and over again. They're not going to change, but they're still your friends. And it's annoying, but that's why they're still your friends. That's what I just love about that scene.
Oh, hell yeah.
And then just to add on to it, because afterwards, after we get out of the diner, here we go. We have Modell and Eddie leaving the diner, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And Eddie says, Modell, do you need a ride home? And he's like, well, if you could, you know, if you're not doing anything right now. And he's like, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm not going anywhere. Do you want a ride home? He's like, well, you know, if it's not out of your way, if it's not going to be a problem. And once again, and he's like, just say you want a ride home. Right. And even after he says that to him, Modell will not follow Eddie's directions. And still, it's like, I really don't want to put you out. And he's like, no, I enjoy your company. I'd be more than happy to take you home. Would you like me to drive you home? And Modell's finally kind of gives in. He's like, yeah, okay, that'd be great. And then they start to walk away. And Eddie turns back, well, do you have gas money? And you see Modell stop like, oh, shit. And he's like, ah, just kidding. Let's go. It almost reinforces what happened at the table with the roast beef sandwich. And it's just such fun banter back and forth. Gutenberg and Reiser just totally click in both of those scenes. They work really well off of each other. And I just really love that. And just, you know, like I said, everything takes place in the diner. And this is where they just go to hang out. Just let it all loose.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact of the matter is, we have friends like this. A friend that you absolutely love as a brother, but has an annoying quirk of some kind. And then you're sitting at a table around with another group of guys, and the quirk comes up, and you all start talking about it, and it just leads to laughter. Because we all have flaws. We all have our own quirks. We all have our own issues. None of us are perfect. And we'll get on each other's nerves from time to time, but we love each other at the end of the day. We're brothers and best friends, and that's all that matters. But these ridiculous conversations will arise as a result. I mean, it's totally relatable. So great stuff, man. So this next one I'm calling Boogie Convinces Carol Heathrow Not to Leave the Theater, because this is the second half of that iconic popcorn scene. Oh, yeah. And we'll touch on this, no pun intended, very briefly. But at this point, and this actually harkens back to that diner scene. I believe it's actually toward the end of the diner scene when they're about to leave, when Boogie tells the other guys that he's got a date with the one and only beautiful Carol Heathrow. And this is one of those moments, I believe, where I think it's either Modell or Eddie, I don't know which one, says, oh, Carol Heathrow, no way, you're not going to be able to get with her. But they're like, oh, yeah, Carol Heathrow, she's death, meaning like she's super hot, man. And Boogie's like, you know what? I'll bet you $20. And this is his language, not mine, the character's language. I'll bet you $20 I get her to touch my pecker. It's like, oh, my God, how juvenile, you know? But he gets the guys to take the action. But of course, this is part of their group dynamic and these inside ways of operating that you always have with your buddies, is that they say, well, they have these bets amongst one another, and they tell him, okay, we'll bet you $20 that you can't do it, that you can't get Carol to touch you, but we've got to be able to validate this. And so he says, all right, well, I'll go to the movie theater. I believe, is it The Strand? Is that the name of the movie theater that they end up going to?
Yes.
So cut to the movie theater, and you have Boogie sitting next to Carol. And of course, the other guys are inconspicuously or otherwise sitting in random spots around the theater where they have a clear line of vision to Boogie and Carol so they can see how is Boogie going to get Carol to touch his junk. Let's just put it bluntly and crudely. So we all know this scene. And what ends up happening is that Boogie puts the popcorn bucket or box in his lap on top of his crotch as Carol is now diving into the popcorn. She's focused on the movie, which now this is 1959. Is it A Summer Place? Is that what they're watching on the screen, Bill Bant? And there's a little sexy moment actually within the film. Carol reaches her hand into the popcorn box and she just keeps taking popcorn out and she's feeding herself. And now Boogie's coming up with a plan, and then he unzips his pants and it basically puts his junk in the bottom of the popcorn box so that when she reaches her hand in, she touches him. And so when she does eventually, and it does happen, we don't see it, it's not too graphic, but she does touch him and she screams out loud and runs out of the theater. So that's that scene. We all know it. It's crazy. It's crude. It's rude, but it's still funny on some level, especially when you've got the other guys that are watching the movie sort of, but mainly paying attention to Boogie, trying to see if he's going to pull this off. And when they see him doing this maneuver with the popcorn box, you could see Fenwick is saying, no way, the bet's off, the bet's off, because he's cheating in a way. It's not as if he's convinced Carol of her own volition to touch him. This is an unintentional, I think they call it unintentional touching later on, something like that. It's pretty funny. So cut to Boogie chases Carol out of the theater, or chases after her, follows her into the bathroom, and she says, that's disgusting, and she's livid. And I put this down as my favorite scene, or one of my favorite scenes, I should say, like the favorite half of this entire scene, because this is Mickey Rourke at his best. This is what he does, and this is what this character does in the movie, and he's incredible at it, and you're just watching him going, wait, there's no way, no way he's going to turn this around. He just pulled this thing where she touched his junk, and that's a major no-no. That's like major, she's going to be turned off forever. There's no way he can save this situation or save this date. And then he goes into this whole story. He says, look, I can explain. It's a little embarrassing to me. And I mean, so maybe if you don't want to hear it, I'll understand. And she says to him, go on. Okay. I want to hear this. Really? I can't wait to hear this. And he says, I don't like to tell this to girls, but you really are a knockout. No, you really are. You know, sitting down next to you in there got me crazy. I got a hard on.
I don't like to admit it, but I did. I mean, you don't know me. I try to come off like I'm being cool all the time, you know, but I don't like to look like I'm hustling. And there I was sitting next to you with a boner. Am I embarrassing you? And she's like, go on. I don't know. It's just that the pain was killing me, you know, to stop the pain. I was digging in. It was digging in the side of my leg. So what I did was, you know, I opened my fly and loosened everything up just to get a little air, and it worked. Everything settled down and I got caught back up into the picture. And then, you know, that's when Sandra, he's talking about the actress in the film, the character in the movie they were watching. She got her leg caught on that bush. She lifted up her dress and, you know, it just popped right up again through the bottom of the popcorn box. The force of it just opened up the flap. And she goes, it just pushed the flap open. Speaking of the bottom of the popcorn box. And he's like, yeah, it's Ripley's. I'm telling you, it just pushed the flap right open. And I couldn't move the box, you know, because then you would have seen it. She's like, oh, that's true. And you're like, son of a bitch, is he actually doing this? Is he actually getting to her to turn around on this with this whole line of bullshit about how he got a hard on and he couldn't do anything about it and it popped through the bottom of the popcorn box? But it's his delivery, the way he does it and his tone. And I didn't do him any service at all in my delivery. I had to speed through it because it's a lot of words, but he manages to do it and gets her to stay. And he gets her to go out with him again. It's unbelievable. I just had to put that down because I love Mickey Rourke. I love how he sells it. I love his natural, well, his performance, but there's a lot of subtlety in it. And it's the tone that he uses. And again, the touching of the hair and his vulnerability, he really turns it on. He knows exactly what to say. And even in his honesty, he's very blunt and he doesn't try to sugarcoat it. He's actually quite honest and she falls for it. I was impressed with Mickey Rourke in that scene. I don't approve of what he did, but impressed by getting her to buy his line of crap.
Yeah. And I think also when you think about it too, the point of the bet is for her to grab his junk. Mission accomplished. He doesn't have to go after her from that point and talk her back.
Good point. Yeah.
Because we find out throughout the movie, he is kind of a ladies man and he admits as much because he works in a beauty parlor and he gets women all the time. So what's the big deal if there's plenty of Carols out there that he can get? So the fact that he does all this, I think even makes it more impressive. So maybe he actually does have feelings for her, but unfortunately, because he needs money, that's why he's doing this. He didn't have to do it at all. He could have just let her walk off and tell the guys, hey, pay up. She touched me.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's a great point. And I think it also shows us that his character has some heart. He's a bit of a jerk in that scene. Well, he's a total jerk in the scene. But when he goes after her, even though he's lying to her, there is some genuine heart underneath it where we're seeing that he's not entirely a bad guy. This is how he operates. This is what he knows. This is what he knows how to do, and he does it well. He's manipulative. That's his MO. Entertaining scene. What do you got next, Bill Bant?
Yeah, so my next favorite scene is a conversation between Eddie and Shrevey, and Eddie's supposed to get married, and everything hinges on this football test. He's going to give this quiz to his fiance, Elise, referred to in the credits as, I believe, the bride. If she does not pass this test, they're not going to get married. And there has been a couple of points throughout the film that people, you know, are asking Eddie why he's getting married. And he keeps saying, well, you know, we've been going out a long time. I figure it's the next thing to do. So he's not even quite sure himself if he should be doing this, regardless of the quiz or not. So we have Eddie and Shrevey. They're outside of the diner and they're kind of leaning on a car. And Eddie asks Shrevey, because he's the only married guy in their group, are you happy with your marriage? And Shrevey responds with, I don't know. And this surprises Eddie because he sees Shrevey and his wife together all the time, which is Beth, played by Ellen Barkin. And usually when they're not at the diner, Beth is with them. She's kind of part of the group. And Eddie just follows up with, what do you mean you don't know? You don't know? And he's like, how could you not? How could you not know? And Shrevey says, I don't know. Beth is terrific and everything, but just, I don't know. I tell you, a big part of the problem, though, when you get married, you know, when you're dating, everything is talking about sex, right? Where can we do it? You know, why can't we do it? Are your parents going to be out so we can do it? You know, trying to get a weekend just so we can do it. And he's like, so they can do it, right? And Shrevey responds, everything is always talking about getting sex and then planning the wedding, all the details. And Eddie's like, yeah, details, shit. And Shrevey comes back, but then when you get married, it's crazy. I don't know. I mean, you can get it whenever you want it. You wake up in the morning and she's there. You come home from work and she's there. And so all that sex planning talk is over with. And so is the wedding planning talk, because you're already married. And Eddie's agreeing with them, right? And Shrevey says, so, you know, I can come down here and we can bullshit the whole night away, but I can't hold a 5-minute conversation with Beth. I mean, it's not her fault. I'm not blaming her. She's great. And Eddie interrupts, yeah, of course not. And Shrevey replies, it's just, we got nothing to talk about. But it's good. It's good. And Eddie agrees, it's good. It's nice, right? And Shrevey's like, yeah, it's nice. And Eddie says, well, we always got the diner. And Shrevey agrees, yeah, we always got the diner. And it's funny listening to that, because, you know, being married myself, and how much of this, I shouldn't say rings true, because I think for the most part, me and my wife are pretty good conversations. I think, especially with the two of them being married so young, mm-hmm. and me and my wife got married in our mid-30s, we had all our experiences and stuff before meeting each other. We lived our lives. We did our own thing. So we have things to always to go back to and discuss. Whereas the two of them being with each other so young, it almost makes sense. It's like, what do you talk about? What experiences can you bring new to the table, because you've almost done everything together? Like, we don't know how long they've been together beforehand, or they know each other since grade school or high school, but you can already see outside of the physical element of it, what else is there to do? What is it that they can talk about, because they've never been away from each other to find those interests and bring it back to the marriage?
I totally believe that, and I agree, and I think it does make sense. I love that scene. I love the fact that Eddie has a few different conversations with different characters about his impending marriage. And it's funny because none of them particularly go very well or are very encouraging. But Eddie is a bit of a dunce and sees the bright side in all of it, the good side of it. And is like, yeah, well, it's nice though, right? It's nice. It'll be okay. Yeah, okay. He just told you that they have basically nothing in common. They have nothing to talk about. I thought it was interesting, too, that Shrevey has that spin on it, because usually the cliche is, oh, once you get married, you never have sex anymore. But his argument was that it's not that you don't have sex anymore. It's that the fun is gone. The thrill of the chase and the challenge is gone, because now you can have it anytime you want it. She's always there. I'm like, oh, I never thought about it that way. That it's now, yeah, it's easy. You can have sex whatever you want. It's not as exciting anymore. So maybe that's why you don't do it as much. I don't know. But anyway.
Wait till they have kids. And then they'll be right back into, when can we do this?
Right. There you go. See? That's funny. But yeah, later on, Eddie does have a conversation with Billy at a pool hall about getting married. And it's a funny moment when he says, yeah, well, yeah, good thing she's not a ball breaker, which is like right on point as they're breaking balls playing pool, and is really, really selfish. Eddie's just all about himself, doesn't even think about what she wants or anything. He just thinks it's the necessary step. Even though he's hearing these stories from these other guys or asking their advice, he's not really listening. I don't know, but I love the scene then he has at the diner later on with Boogie admitting to being a virgin and feeling as though maybe he's missing out on things. And he has a real vulnerable moment there. Eddie does. Steve Guttenberg is really good in that particular scene, which is very brief. But he has this, it's almost as if he goes pale, realizing, oh, maybe I'm missing out on things. And then Boogie looks at him and goes, yeah, that's what marriage is. It's like, holy shit. What do you mean? Once you get married, you're just going to miss out on all the other things? Which, of course, is not true. But like, it's just kind of matter of fact.
I think it's true to a point, but you do gain things at the same time.
Right.
So I think what Boogie says is that was actually right, but to a point.
Mm-hmm. But back to your point, Bill Banff, the point is too, though, is that they just don't have a whole lot of life experience. If you don't want to miss out on things, well, then you better sow your wild oats now. Do it now. Or take your time and make sure you give yourself the opportunity to have the experiences before getting married. But it seems as though Eddie's made his decision. Anyway, great scene, Bill Banff. I'm glad you chose that because of that great period on that conversation when they said, well, we'll always have the diner.
Yeah. All right, what do you have next, Jason?
All right, my next scene is what I'm calling Billy and Barbara have a conversation at the TV station. This is the TV station where Barbara works, and we've been introduced as character Barbara because we know at this point that Billy has been longtime friends with her, and over this long time, he's developed feelings for her, and at one point when they were together in New York City, they slept together. This happened sometime recently in the past, within the last month, I believe it was. But as a result, Barbara got pregnant, and she tells Billy as much. And he's just gotten back for this Christmas vacation and to be back for Eddie's wedding because he's going to be Eddie's best man. And he wanted to see Barbara because Barbara's also one of his best friends, although she is obviously a girl and he actually wants more than to be a friend. And she tells him that she's pregnant, which is really dropping a bomb on him. And he gets this information and then professes his love for her and feels that he should share the responsibility of taking care of the child and wants to marry her. But she's reluctant and she thinks he's confusing what love is and that he doesn't really want to marry her he wants to marry her for the wrong reasons. So she's made it pretty clear that she doesn't want to marry him. And at this point in the movie, Billy goes to the TV station where she's working. He's going to put his foot down here. So he's kind of in a heated state and he raises his voice a little bit and he says that he's got a say in this pregnancy. And he's really trying to make the statement here. But Barbara is a bit standoffish as they're walking through the hallway of this TV station and studio. And she says, she's not going to do anything drastic like get an abortion, don't worry. But he feels like he's being ignored. And she keeps telling him to keep his voice down, but Billy follows her around. And she again says, lower your volume, because they're actually taping a show in the studio there next door to where they're located in this entire TV station. So then we cut to the TV directors, the director's control booth. This is where the producers or director of the TV show sits, and they're behind a big electronic board with all the dials and such, and they're watching television monitors where they're recording a show. And we see these two producers who are working on the show, and they say, okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break. And one of the producers leaves. Another one is just sitting in his chair. And in the background of the actual control booth, we see a see-through window looking into the sound recording booth next door, where now Billy and Barbara have walked in and they're continuing their conversation about what to do about her pregnancy. Billy now takes the conversation to a kind of a quieter, softer level and seriously asks her what they're going to do about the baby. And what I love here is that as an audience, we're watching a lot of this conversation from the actual control room through this window, looking into the sound booth where Billy and Barbara are having the conversation. And one of the producers is still sitting there in the control booth, but he has his back to them as they're in the sound booth behind him. And in front of this producer in the control booth, we see these various TV screens I mentioned. And on a couple of these TV screens, there happens to be an old movie playing, a black and white movie of the time. And it's playing and we hear this dialogue between the actors in that movie. And it's a relationship scene between a man and a woman. So you have that scene on this TV screen juxtaposed against this scene that's playing in real time between Barbara and Billy. So we're watching Barbara and Billy through the sound glasses. They're standing in the sound booth. And as the producer is sitting with his back to them, they begin to have their conversation, but we can't really hear what Barbara's saying. But Billy sits on a control panel in the sound booth and turns on the mic. And you see the little on-air sign turn on. And now you can hear their dialogue coming through into the control booth. But what's really smart about this is we're also watching this black and white movie on the little TV screens. And the dialogue from Billy and Barbara is timed perfectly with the dialogue coming from the old black and white movie on the TV screen, so that when there's pauses in the old classic movie between the actor's dialogue, you get the dialogue from Billy and Barbara over the mic and coming through into the control booth. And so the producers that's sitting there doesn't realize that he's privy to this very private conversation that's happening between Barbara and Billy about her being pregnant. What are they going to do about this baby? So it's a really smart scene. It's actually quite like tender between Billy and Barbara, because they finally, she admits to having a special feeling for him, but and Billy says he should marry her. And she says, I'm not going to marry you out of convenience just because that's what everyone else does. And he replies, you think I want to marry you because that's what everyone else does? But the point is, it's a smartly choreographed, planned out scene. It's inventive. And the fact that you have this classic movie playing in the foreground, which is a relationship scene, and then the actual relationship scene taking place in real time behind it. It's dramatic and slightly humorous. And I liked, again, how the scene was portrayed. I thought it was some smart filmmaking and a good direction and a great idea by Levinson and crew. Great idea for a scene.
Yeah, just that one shot of the control booth, and you see one of the technicians in there, and then in the background, they're in that soundproof. Really well done. I thought that was really cool.
I had to play it a couple of times because I thought that they had choreographed it in a way where Barbara and Billy were actually saying the lines from the movie.
Oh.
The black and white movie we're watching on the TV screen, as if it was almost a kind of a fantasy sequence. I thought it was really cool. It was just the way they timed it was that Billy and Barbara were saying their dialogue during the pauses between the dialogue of the actors in the movie, which was really smart. So it all kind of flowed together. It's really cool. Cool scene.
Yeah, I thought that storyline itself was interesting because in the beginning, when Billy comes back and he goes to see Eddie, and Eddie asks something about Barbara,
mm-hmm.
Are you sleeping with her yet? And Billy's like, no, we've just been friends. And Eddie's like, you've been friends for 6 years and you haven't slept together? That's odd. And then we find out when Billy goes to the church to meet with her, and then she says, well, I thought she said she thought she was pregnant. I don't know if we ever find out she's actually pregnant.
I assume she is pregnant because, I mean, he's pretty adamant about wanting to be there for her and that they should get married. And I don't know if he would be that serious about it if she didn't even know for sure she was pregnant.
Yeah. But just the fact that here he is, he's trying to do what he thinks is the right thing, not necessarily the right thing. And she's so easily rebuffs him.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, considering here we are in 1959, and that's not how things were back then, I guess.
I actually appreciated her character for that fact that at that time, she's acting as a very independent woman, making what she feels are the best choices for her as an individual, as a person that is not married, that is not in a relationship. She's not sure about her feelings for him and doesn't want to rush into a marriage. That is a running theme throughout this. I mean, we have Eddie that feels like he's going into this marriage and just not sure about things, but it's planned. It's almost set in stone already. We know that Shrevey is already married at a very young age. And now here's a situation where Billy might be rushing things just because she's pregnant. And she's like, hold on. We've got to let the dust settle and make sure we know where we stand with each other before any kind of major decision is made. But he's automatically wanting to be the good guy, be there for her and be this chivalrous stand-up guy. But she's like, I appreciate it, but I don't know if that's what I want. And I think he realizes that.
We never find out what the resolution is.
Right.
Because there's a scene later when Eddie and Billy go to a strip bar and then they're at another, like a food joint with the stripper. And the stripper asks Billy if, you know, he's married or has someone. And he says, I'm in love with someone, but they're not in love with me. And she says, well, have you shown her that you love her? So then you're thinking, oh, okay, something's going to happen where he's going to show how much he cares.
Right.
And then we cut to the wedding and we see them dancing, but we don't really see that moment that the stripper was talking about.
Yeah.
And then the movie ends. So we have no idea what happens with Billy and Barbara. It's a mystery.
Yeah.
So it does kind of leave you hanging, but I did like that. All right. For me, it's a moment. And this is like two movies in a row. I'm just loving credits because So the way this movie closes out is Eddie gives Elise the football test and she actually fails. She misses it by 2 points. So the wedding is supposedly off. But then Eddie reconsiders and realizes because Trevi gave away one of the answers and he didn't include it, but she really did know the answer because she did follow it up with specifics. So he's like, all right, I'll give her the points. And they get married and we see the wedding. And the last shot is of our five main characters together. And it kind of does a quick freeze frame. And then it goes into the credits. And then during the credits, instead of having a song, because we've had all this wonderful music throughout the movie, we just overhear a conversation of the guys at the diner. And it's Modell, and he's trying to tell a joke that he recently heard. And he cannot get the joke out because he keeps getting interrupted by the other guys. And it's supposed to be about the guy goes in the bar and goes to order a drink. And then Modell forgets part of the joke. And then they're making fun of Modell because he couldn't remember the whole joke. And it goes on and on and on. And then credits end. We never get to the punchline. But even after all of this has happened with them in this past week, they still have the diner. And that's what the movie's about. It's about the diner. And it even emphasizes there at the end. And I think it's one of the few times that I can think of where we see credits and usually we'll see footage along with dialogue. This is just dialogue only, literally going over the credits.
Yep.
And we just hear them talking the whole time and everyone's just busting on Modell just trying to tell this joke. And then movie's over. I just thought it was really cool. It's just not something we see a lot of. I can't even think of another example because maybe it'll be a scene going along or, you know, we did Private Benjamin a couple episodes ago when we just see Judy Benjamin just kind of walking off while the credits are rolling or Romancing the Stone where we just see the boat going down the streets of New York. But never do we just hear a conversation going on. Not say never. I'm sure it's happened before, but I can't think of any other examples. And that's what I just liked about it. It's like, okay. I like this little twist.
I loved it. I thought it was totally original. I haven't seen anything or heard anything like that before, just hearing the dialogue over the credits. It's really funny. And the fact that they don't get to the punchline of the joke, the whole scene is a microcosm of the movie, right? I mean, the movie is about the journey. It's not about the punchline. It's not about what happens at the end. We don't know what happens between Billy and Barbara. We don't know if Eddie and Elise will be happy as a married couple. There's other things we don't know. I mean, what's going on with Fenwick? What's going on with Fenn and his dysfunctional family and his drinking problem?
Yep.
Does he take it easy on the booze? Does he get his act cleaned up? Does he resolve issues with his brother, whom he's quite estranged from? Or does Boogie continue with his gambling? What seems to be a bit of a gambling addiction that he has? Or his womanizing ways. We don't get any of that, but it doesn't matter. And I didn't feel mad about it.
Right. You don't feel cheated.
No. We just got the privilege of getting to know these people a little bit about their lives. And it was actually really entertaining. And it made me think about my friends and my relationship to my friends and those in-between moments, the journey we shared together, not how we ended up or where we ended up. So yeah, those the great call. Great call. I'm glad you brought that up because that's really funny. Listening to that and actually you it actually is a good way to get you to watch the entire credits at the end, to watch it all the way through because you want to know what the punchline is going to be. And of course, then there is no punchline. You're like, oh, that makes sense because that is the movie.
Yep.
Hello, this is Jason, co-host of the All 80s Movies Podcast, with a message from Factor Meals. Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer, thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you will always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you will always have new flavors to explore. Treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. Head to factormeals.com/80smovies50 and use code 80smovies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code 80smovies50 at factormeals.com/80smovies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, it's time for Swiss Cheese and Complaints Department. And why do we call it Swiss Cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have popcorn box holes.
Yes, if it doesn't have those popcorn box holes, we just file a complaint with the Complaints Department. So what do you got, Jason, for some cheese or complaint?
I tell you what, this is a very slight one, but the very opening of the movie, it's supposed to be Christmas night. But none of the whole entire opening sequence, whether it be the Christmas dance or going into the diner sequence, feels like Christmas much at all. Now, the Christmas dance, there are wreaths that are up. There are some Christmas lights. There is a Christmas tree in the background. But literally everyone in the Christmas dance scene and the diner scene that follows is wearing brown, black, gray, tweed, jackets, pants, dress. There's no, it just didn't feel like Christmas to me. I didn't catch it until the second time I watched it. I'm like, I don't know why this doesn't feel like Christmas.
I'm 100% there with you. That was one of my complaints. It's the holidays, but no one talks about that. We'll see a Christmas tree here or there. We'll see some Christmas lights, and we have the scene with the nativity scene, but no one wishes anyone happy holidays at any point or Merry Christmas at any point. Granted, nope. Some of our characters are Jewish, so I understand that, but they still don't say happy holidays to one another. We do hear an occasional Christmas song in the soundtrack. I was kind of bummed even at the wedding because it happens on New Year's Eve. There's no like countdown to the new year scene in that either.
Right.
It's a holiday movie that does not have no holiday feeling. Die Hard. See, Die Hard has more holiday feeling than this movie does.
It is a Christmas movie, damn it.
Yes. For me, you kind of talked about it a little bit. You even kind of said in your description when you were talking about Fenwick, when he crashes the car and all the guys get out to check on Fen.
Yeah.
Like my first thing would have been, where the hell's Diane?
Yeah.
I would have been more worried about her because you don't even see her. I'm expecting to see her up in a tree or something. If she never popped out, I don't think the guys would have even realized that she was in the car. I was like, Jesus, man. I would have been worried. You see Fenwick, he's already there dead, but what the hell happened to Diane? Where the hell did she go?
Yeah, the women in this movie get the short end of the stick.
Oh, big time.
Sure. There's no question. I think it's done, a lot of it's done purposefully, but they still are underserved for sure. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up that scene because there's some questions there, especially like I'm loving that ride. I wish I could tell you what the model car that it is that Fenwick is driving, but to take that car and on purpose turn it onto its side like that, I'd be like, no, I'm not going that far for a joke because you're going to scratch the hell out of it and you could do some real damage to your vehicle. Why would you do that to that car? But I think you see later on, first of all, it's in character for him. He's a little crazed. Kevin Bacon is unlike I've ever seen him in any other role in this movie. He's drunk most of the time and he's a little bit in his head and does some weird shit. And that's who he is. He's dealing with some stuff. He's got some inner turmoil and he acts out. He acts out. We see him in the Christmas dance. He's in the basement and he's punching out glass panes, like glass windows, and thinks it's a kick. He says it's a smile and then Boogie has to stop him. And then he pulls off this practical joke. And I'm like, why would you do that to this car? But he doesn't give a damn about the car. And you see the car is a little bit rusted out anyway or whatever later on. Then also the other thing is they would have to have really gotten way, way ahead of the other cars in order to pull that joke off. To have time to pull over, get out of the car, tip the car onto its side, then get into the right position by the time the other guys caught up to him. This is pretty well staged.
Yeah.
In a matter of a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
It's nitpicky. It still worked for me. I wasn't pissed off by the scene or was like, oh, this is stupid or anything. But I had some questions.
Yeah, because even the nativity scene when he goes crazy because the guys are trying to get him out of sitting in the manger in his underwear.
Yeah.
The baby was stolen, so he was going to be the baby.
Right.
He's got to be on something else besides alcohol.
Yeah, it seemed as though, he was on some some pills or something.
Yes.
But that was pretty funny too. Yeah. He's out of his mind. Mm-hmm. And you don't ever get to really understand why.
No.
You just know he's got problems and that's it. What else do you really need to know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we care about him though. It's like, oh, you want him to get better, but, or be okay. We don't get enough time with him.
No.
My next issue here is mainly with Eddie, but
okay,
that character, man, it starts with Billy. He gets picked up from the train station by the guys, which is great. He's going to be Eddie's best man. Eddie doesn't show up to pick him up from the train station, which is wild. It's like, you should probably be one of the guys to go to the train station to pick him up. He's your best man. Eddie doesn't go. The other guys go. So Billy then goes with those guys to the diner and then decides to go over to Eddie's house to check in on him and walks in. And there's Eddie's mom greeting him at the door saying, oh, Billy, I didn't know you were in town. He's like, yeah, I got back. And obviously he's there to be there for Eddie's wedding. But also he's like, yeah, I know there's some good parties and, you know, for the Christmas vacation and stuff. And Eddie's mom goes to Billy, did you know your parents were out of town? And Billy goes, oh, no, I didn't. I'm like, wait, what? Billy just came home and didn't bother to check with his parents. He's coming back home and didn't know his parents were in Florida. That was kind of weird to me. Anyway, he goes up to Eddie's room to find Eddie still sleeping. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. Eddie is still asleep. Eddie's, by the way, still living with his parents at home. He's living at home. He's sleeping until 2:30. He doesn't go to the train station to pick up his best man. His best man has to come to his house, wake him up. And then when he wakes up, he's just kind of gross. He lights up a smoke, goes into the bathroom, brushes his teeth with water, splashes some water on his face, kind of razzes Billy a little bit. Billy's like, hey, you know, it would be nice if you came and picked me up. Then they go downstairs and Eddie treats his mom like crap and demands his mom make him a sandwich. And Billy's watching the whole time going, who is this guy? And so I'm watching it going, who is this guy? I'm like, this is a self-centered prick. But Steve Gutenberg somehow throughout all of it is somehow likable, a likable douche. I'm like, who would want to marry this guy? That was my final question. So,
oh, no way I would have made that sandwich for him. I would have maybe took the ingredients out and slapped them on the table in front of him and said, make your own effing sandwich.
Slap him with some roast beef.
Well, bologna.
Is that what he wanted? A fried bologna sandwich?
But no way I'm making it for him.
So that was my complaint, is just that Eddie's a self-centered jerk.
Oh, yeah.
But he's supposed to be. I just didn't like it. But he is written that way, like he's supposed to be.
Yeah. All right. I have another Steve Gutenberg complaint. It was tough watching him dance in that scene.
Yeah.
What are you doing? That was awful.
It's hilarious. He's convulsing. It's hilarious.
Some of it was okay, but I would never do that in public.
No, he's terrible. But I give him credit. He went for it.
Yeah. He got better on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Yep.
I was cringing.
It's uncomfortable. I totally agree. It's uncomfortable. So I'm going to jump ahead and I'm going to go into this little tidbit later. But so a couple of years ago was the 40th anniversary of this film. And some of the cast members got together at the TCMFF, the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. And you can watch, there's a 20-minute video clip on YouTube. And it's great. I loved it. And I took a lot of it for our fun facts and trivia segment. But jumping ahead, they ask him about that particular sequence. The moderator asks Steven Gutenberg, funny. So was that dance actually choreographed or did you make that up on the spot? And he's like, oh, yeah, no. That was Bob Fosse. They got Bob Fosse to come in and we took 2 weeks to work. Of course, he's totally joking and the audience was laughing. And Steve Gutenberg says it with such a straight face and just is really like right, jumps right on it. Very clever. And Steve Gutenberg comes off great in this whole thing. It's Steve Gutenberg, Paul Reiser, Tim Daly, and Kevin Bacon are the four that made it for that particular screening of the film at the film festival for the anniversary. And they're all wonderful. But Steve Gutenberg is very likable and charming and was joked. But yes, he clearly made it up. He improvised that whole thing. And it is uncomfortable to watch. He's just kind of shaking the whole time.
Anything else?
No, I have nothing else to complain about this great movie.
No. I'm moving on to, hey, it's an actor.
All right.
So in this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's, hey, it's an actor. Who do we choose this week, Jason?
We choose for our Hey, It's That actor, Michael Tucker. Michael Tucker as Bagel. So I mentioned Bagel earlier. He was the adult in the room, if you will, at the diner. And he's the one that kind of warns Boogie about placing bets that he can't pay in case he loses. And of course, he does lose. And at the end of the film, when we think Boogie's going to get his butt kicked or worse by this thug named Tank, who's come to collect on this debt that Boogie owes, it turns out that Bagel paid off his debt for him. And so what a relief. Boogie is saved by Bagel. And Bagel says, well, how about this? You come work for me. You can pay off your debt that way. So Bagel's a good guy. And he's looking out for Boogie because out of respect for his father, I believe he says. Anyway, Michael Tucker's great in this very small role. But Michael Tucker is a Baltimore-born actor himself. And his career goes back to the early 70s. He was credited as Man at Desk in the film Network in 1976. And then he was also in An Unmarried Woman in 1978. Both those films were nominated for Best Picture. Not bad. He was in The Eyes of Laura Mars in 78 as well. Diner here in 82. He's Gil's agent in Woody Allen's The Purple Rose of Cairo in 85. And then another Woody Allen film, Radio Days in 87. Then he returns to work with Barry Levinson once again in Tin Men in 1987. And guess what role he plays in Tin Men? Bagel. He reprises his role as Bagel. Bagel comes back. All right. And you may know Michael Tucker best as the character Stuart Markowitz from 171 episodes of the TV show L.A. Law. We know Bill Bant's a fan of L.A. Law.
Love, right? L.A. Law.
Yeah, that was from 86 to 94, for which Michael Tucker was nominated for 3 Emmys for that show. But you know who was nominated for 5 Emmys on that show, Bill Bant? Michael Tucker's wife, Jill Eikenberry, who played Ann Kelsey on the show. Michael and Jill were married and would go on to maintain their working relationship in several TV movies. And I also want to mention that Michael Tucker was in a couple episodes of the show Nowhere Man, which featured Bruce Greenwood in 95. And that show got canceled way too soon. Love that show. Just want to give a shout out to Nowhere Man. And then he was also in Till There Was You in 97, which was one of my first extra gigs. That's the only one reason why I'm mentioning that movie. He was also in D2, The Mighty Ducks, L.A. Law, the movie. And other than that, over the years, he's done a bunch of episodic television, including The Tracy Ullman Show, The Practice, Judging Amy, and Law and Order. According to Michael Tucker, he was cast in Diner based on his Baltimore accent and not his acting ability. Here's a little fun tidbit. Michael Tucker shares the same birthday, February 6th, and same city of birth, Baltimore, as Baseball Hall of Fame great Babe Ruth. Michael Tucker is now 79, still married to Jill, and was still working as recently as 2023. He is our Hey, It's That actor.
Big smile when I forgot he was in this movie. Yes, I was a huge L.A. Law fan.
Yep.
All right, time to move on to facts and trivia. What are some facts and trivia we have about Diner?
Test screening reactions of the film were poor, prompting uncertainty from MGM over whether to release the film. Attempting to get positive publicity for the film, executive producer Mark Johnson obtained a print without MGM's knowledge and screened it privately for Pauline Kael, whom his mother knew personally, as well as fellow critic James Walcott. Kael called MGM executives and made it clear she was going to write a rave review even if MGM did not release the film, and that other critics planned to do the same.
Our director, Barry Levinson, started writing the screenplay in early 1980 after conversations with Mel Brooks, with whom Levinson had collaborated during the mid to late 70s on both Silent Movie and High Anxiety as a screenwriter. The executive producer of this movie was Mark Johnson, who had been an assistant director of Brooks's High Anxiety in 1977. Johnson later teamed with producer Jerry Weinthrop at MGM, which is where Weinthrop and Johnson decided to collaborate as producers on making this movie as producer and executive producer, respectively. So Mel Brooks had a little hand in Diner.
Very cool. The film inspired a 1983 television pilot written and directed by Levinson. Mike Binder starred as Eddie. Paul Reiser returned as Modell. Michael Madsen took over as Boogie. I could see that. And James Spader was Fenwick. Could see that as well.
Yeah.
Great cast. And speaking of which, Bill and I were talking about this offline, I think after the recording of our previous episode. I want to see this pilot. Would love to see the pilot. Did it ever air? I don't know. And we need to have a specific television channel or streaming network dedicated to the lost pilot episodes. We want to see them. And this would be perfect for that.
Definitely. So the bride in the movie, known as Elise on the credits, is a central character in the film, but is rarely seen. Her name is Sharon Zinman, who happens to be the sister of Barry Levinson.
Barry Levinson claims that the infamous football quiz that Eddie forces his fiance to pass is based on something that one of his male cousins did in real life. Unbelievable.
Craziness. So this was the first of 15 films Ralph DeBakken, who plays the customer Shrevey deals with, made with Barry Levinson. 15 projects together.
Wow. At times during filming, when friction between actors got out of hand, Barry Levinson ushered them into a small trailer that the cast nicknamed the Camaraderie Camper. Love that. All right, I'm going to run through a few things. One, it is claimed that James Spader is a dancing extra for a few seconds in the opening dance, the Christmas dance. Now, I looked for him. I think I saw him. You can't really see his face, though. He's kind of turned away from the screen. And he's wearing glasses and his hair is slicked back, but it sure looks like him from behind. You can't really tell though. Anyway, I mentioned this conversation with the cast of Diner at the TCMFF, the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival 2022, the 40th anniversary of Diner. Few notable moments from it. It's just great. Watch it. But Kevin Bacon talks about turning down his contract extension on Guiding Light, the soap opera. And he had no prospects after that. And then thankfully, 2 weeks after that, got this audition for Diner. Gutenberg was debating going to school and becoming a dentist. Thank God he didn't. Tim Daly was really green at this time, had trouble hitting his marks. Paul Reiser talks about also being green and that his first shot was the first shot that they shot in, for him in the movie, was the actual opening shot of the film, and they were using a Steadicam. But he didn't know what a Steadicam was, and he was thinking, why couldn't he get the regular camera like the other guys? Why do I get the baby camera? Like it's a tricycle. And he felt really insecure about it.
I love that story.
This is one of the maybe the origination of the Breakfast Club. They were all staying at a local Holiday Inn. Kevin Bacon remembers asking the Holiday Inn to keep the hotel bar open in the morning because after an all-night shoot, they go to the bar and have some drinks before going to bed. And Tim Daly recounts scaring the tourists that would see them boozing it up in the morning and being rowdy from being all charged up from the shoot the night before. And Tim Daly also mentions how great the writing really is in this movie and how there are so many great lines and how they're overlooked. And couldn't agree more. I wish this movie were quoted more. So many great, great lines in this. That's all I got, Bill Bent.
And there is a great Kevin Bacon story where he talks about the screening. And then he's in the bathroom and a guy recognizes him.
He literally skipped over that one. Yeah, it's great.
And the guy goes, oh, you were in that movie. And Kevin's like, yeah. And he's all excited, think he's going to get praised. The guy's like, yeah, that movie's a real sleeper. I slept right through it. And Kevin's like, oh, shit. My career's over.
Yep.
Little did he know. Moving on to box office. Diner was released on April 2nd, 1982 in a handful of theaters. On an estimated budget of $5 million, it grossed $12.5 million domestically. It never reached the top 10 at the box office, but was in the theaters for 8-plus months. The most money the movie grossed in 1 week was in September, when it reached $1.7 million. Diner was the 54th highest grossing movie of 1982 here in the United States, just behind They Call Me Bruce and ahead of Visiting Hours. Moving on to reviews, when growing up in the 80s, we would watch sneak previews with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear their reviews and watch clips of upcoming movies. Their review of Diner was unanimous. 2 thumbs up. Gene thought it was one of the year's best movies, consisting of great moments and characters we identify with. Roger also loved the picture and identified with some of the characters. He also thought the one attitude we see throughout the movie is the guy's fear of women, because although they may think and seem like they are macho, they don't know how to deal with women. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 92% with an audience score of 77%, and it has an IMDb rating of 7.1. This brings us to additional thoughts and questions. What are some additional thoughts and questions we have about Diner?
Bill Bant, my question for you off the bat is, what was your diner or diners when growing up? Your hangouts with you and your buds post-college or even in college maybe or whenever?
When I was with the Dolphins, we used to go to a place all the time. It was called the Quarterdeck, and it was right across the street from the Dolphins training facility or our headquarters. We were there a lot, and they were a sponsor, so I had like a 50% off card. So a lot of times I would take our interns there and just, you know, I would treat them to the 50% off so they wouldn't have to pay full price. But we were there a lot.
I hear you.
If I didn't have an appearance or an event that night and I wasn't going to the movies, that's probably where you could find me. The Quarterdeck or the Ale House, the Davy Ale House. It was like right around the corner up the road. That was my two big places. I miss those places a lot. I just don't feel like there's a place like that here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's great, man. I absolutely love it. Well, I've got several. I mean, and man, these all hold a very special place in my heart. Back in the day, just post-college and even during my college years and before, I'm just going to say it was Alan Noon's basement. That was our diner. He had a little man-made little wooden bar there that we would drink a little old-style, little Chicago-style beer there. Sometimes that was just the go-to. We would go there before we went out or after we went out. We would just hang out in Al Noon's basement. So shout out to Al Noon. And then at times it was the Vegas Cafe in Antioch, Illinois, or the Limerick in Antioch, Illinois, or JT's Roadhouse in Illinois. These were all diners for my buddies and I. Shout out to all you guys if you're listening. And then moving on to my later years post-college and moving out to Los Angeles. I mean, gosh, in Montrose, it's Avignon's, which I mentioned on this podcast. Gilligan's Irish Pub, that's near and dear to my heart. Leo's All-Stars, the Baru, a.k.a. Fat Dog, a.k.a. Basin 41. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention also in Glendale, there's this bar called Bar Farniente because it was attached to a restaurant called Farniente. And so it was called Bar FN, as in barfin. This is amazing.
That's cool.
But I can't leave this one off the list. It has to be Bordner's on Cherokee Avenue in Hollywood. Shout out to Pat Duty and Chris Valenziano and all of you that joined us at Bordner's over the years. That for sure was a diner of ours. Or when I say diner, I mean basically like dive bar, restaurant, etc. It was our version of the diner in this movie. So many, many places where I have a lot of wonderful memories with great friends and a lot of great laughs. What do you have for additional thoughts and questions, Bill Bant?
I had to think about this because one of the storylines in the movie is that Boogie makes his $2,000 bet on a basketball game and he does not have the money to cover this. So I was like, well, how much is that in today's dollars? So I looked it up and it would be $21,200.
Yeah.
That's a lot of change.
It's a chunk of change.
Yeah.
That's a good additional thought. Additional thoughts I've had were the days of staying up all night, going to the diner, you know, after a long night of drinking, just because you have the munchies, and then you walk out and the sun's coming up and you could get away with it and not just be completely ruined for the next week.
Right.
We could do that when we were younger. I also looked at the other side of things, working at the diner. Oh my gosh, it would be tough running that place and working at that particular diner, handling the clientele that would come in at that hour. Also, I think we could learn a lot from this movie today, as in, this is how needle drops are done. I freaking loved the music in this film. As I mentioned, 50s songs, the 50s hits. They're great songs, but they are nicely placed throughout this, and it makes sense where they're placed, and they're not forced down your throat. And we get a lot of that in our TV series now, our streaming series. It's just needle drop after needle drop. It's like, yeah, we get it. Some of them are really on the nose. Come on, we got to take it easy. Let's back off. But man, it works so well in this movie. Just love the music. Hey, Bill Bant, I love the character of Methan in this. He's this guy that randomly shows up and just quotes old movies. He speaks as the character in the movie. I believe it seems as though he's got some mental issues, but he's just like a friend of theirs. I just thought it was a great character. He just walks up to them randomly, either at the diner or at the pool hall, just spouting lines from a movie. And they just kind of go along with it. And they wait till he's done and he walks off. It's like, what was that? But again, we've all had some friend like that.
I was like, oh, he has all of us bested.
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple other things. What else do you have for additional thoughts and questions?
All right, so I have a question for you. You are cast in the movie and you get to play any role you want. Who do you choose and which role would you not want?
Oh, gosh. That's a wonderful question. What character would I choose? Probably I would choose... Here's my honest answer. I would choose Boogie. I would want to play that role because I think it would be a challenge and it would be a lot of fun to take on that challenge. But I don't personally feel... that is me. I don't think I would be right for that part. I would probably choose Billy, the Tim Daly role.
Okay.
Now, the role I wouldn't want, It'd be a toss-up between Modell and Eddie, because I just don't like Eddie's character. Not that I couldn't play a kind of a douchey goofball, but that doesn't attract me, that type of part. You know, and when it comes to acting, a lot of it is really bringing yourself to the part. I used to, you know, when I moved out to LA, a lot of young actors will be under the assumption it's about becoming someone else. When you're playing a different character or taking on the life of a different character, you have to morphing into a different person, which you cannot physically or mentally do. Otherwise, you'd be insane. So you just bring yourself to the part and have to understand you are unique unto yourself. So when you take on a role, the role will be different than anyone else because it's you, because you're different from anyone else. So I have to be honest with who I believe I am and who I've been told I am. And I just don't think I'd be Eddie, thankfully. And I couldn't be Modell because I'm just not that quick. I've always had a fear of improv and I'm just not. I think sometimes I can be fast on my feet or have that type of humor, but he's just so clever and witty and really just really funny. So yeah, I would choose Billy. I'd want to be Boogie.
Okay.
What about you? Do you have an answer for that? Even though I know you're not an actor per se, but I mean, if you had a chance, like let's say you were and you had a chance to portray one of these roles, who would you choose?
I would actually choose Modell.
Yeah.
Just come in, do my thing, get out.
Right. Yeah.
That's what I want. As for the one I would not want, I actually would not want Fenwick. I would not want Kevin Bacon's role.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a tough one. Who's good, man? They're all so good in this. Mm-hmm. And I wish Modell was in it more. He's like the sixth wheel,
yeah.
But he's still great. And I understand. I mean, it's not necessary that he be in it more, really, but because he is so funny.
Paul Reiser does tell a funny story about that, too, when he gives his friend the script and he reads and he's like, are you in this movie?
That's a great
story. I don't think you're in it.
Because he was just doing stand-up and it was like the guy that owned the restaurant or bar, wherever he would perform, was like his agent, his like stand-in agent, and looked at the script and read it. He's like, wait, Paul, what role are you playing? He's like, Modell. It's like, hate to break it to you, pal, but you're not in this movie. Because he didn't have any lines. He just went in and improvised.
Yeah.
That's what they told him. That's great. Anyway, that's all I got. Any other additional thoughts from you, my friend?
I am good. I think it's time for us to move on to our rating. So on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn buckets, what do you give Diner?
I'm giving this 4 popcorn buckets. I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Some movies may not appear to be impactful at first. And I have to admit, upon first watch, I was like, okay. But then I thought about it. I started taking notes. I watched it again. And I realize, man, this movie just hits me in a certain way. It may not hit everyone that way, but it got me. And although I originally didn't have a nostalgic attachment to it, it now really makes me feel nostalgic for those times, those nights at the diners, or my version of those of the diners with my old friends. And some of them are still my friends to this day, thankfully. And so it may have been better that I didn't see it until now to have a better appreciation for it, for the writing, the direction, the performances, the soon-to-be star actors. But most importantly, it makes me grateful for my friends and those diners. And it was uncomfortable to see some of these characters and their behavior, because it reminded me of how I was also at that time and at that age, just trying to figure things out and coming to that point, that decision to actually start growing up. And it's not just a coming of age movie. It's about the, you know, this realization that things do have to change. And I'm still working on that, to be honest, even at age 50. But there is an honesty in this movie that I really recognized and really appreciate. So 4 popcorn buckets for me. I understand why this is a classic now. How about you, Bill Bant?
Yeah, this is 4 popcorn buckets for me too. And this is the type of movie that I just love when you see successful actors and where they started. And for a handful of them, this is where it actually did start for them. It was debut for them. And to knock it out of the park this early is amazing. The movie, in a way, is just a little time capsule of life back then. And the amazing thing, as much things change over time, we're still going through the same stuff they were going back through then, too. You see yourself in maybe one or two of these characters, and it makes you think of what it was like when you were that age, too. I just really enjoyed going back and watching this one.
Awesome.
I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please take the time to follow us on your preferred streaming platform, give us a review, and rate us. If you want to learn more about our show, you can visit us at all80smoviespodcast.com. For our next episode, we'll be discussing Kroll, sci-fi adventure starring Ken Marshall, Lisette Anthony, and Freddie Jones. If you can join us, have an excellent week, everyone.
Bill Bant, you'll always rate right up there. Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.